Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air.
The road to agroecology in Sri Lanka, how green policies are not enough without a just economic and social transition. Before the Green Revolution came to Sri Lanka in the 1960s, with the imposition of modernized machinery, high-yielding varieties, increased use of fertilizers and other agrochemical inputs, the country had an ecologically sustainable agricultural system. Farmers used mixed farming techniques and cultivated in a manner that protected the natural environment and human health. They maintained soil fertility through the use of cattle manure, crop rotation and planting shrubs and trees next to crops so as to increase farm productivity and improve soil health. It used to be a very interactive system, says Chalani Rubasinghe from the Center for Environmental Justice or Friends of the Earth Sri Lanka. But with the Green Revolution, along came the massive application of fertilizers and other inputs to support crops, and eventually farmers lost fertility in the croplands, which further increased their dependency on external applications, she explains. The main goal of those who brought the Green Revolution to Sri Lanka was to increase total agricultural production, particularly in terms of rice, which would improve the living conditions of rural people. Unfortunately, it did not result in poverty reduction. A study conducted by the Center for Environmental Justice in 2012 came across a number of malpractices in the way farmers used fertilizers, such as applying chemicals to target insects in larva stages instead of adult insects, thus rendering pesticides ineffective or mixing different chemical substances without knowing the final effects. Ultimately, the Green Revolution Sri Lanka was not successful in securing a healthy or sufficient quantity of food at a fair price, highlighted Rubasinghe. Let's now listen to the interview with Chalani.
Sri Lanka had a very sustainable agriculture system earlier. So they cultivated in a manner that protect the natural environment, sustain the living beings and protected the human health. They practiced mixed crop cultivation where various crops were cultivated in various places in the paddy field. They used cattle whose dung fertile the soil, and they changed the crop from paddy to legumes to vegetables to tubers or root vegetables. So this way they maintained the soil fertility without needing to apply so much fertilizer. Also, they practiced agroforestry where some shrubs and trees were planted beside crops, which can increase farm productivity and improve soil health. So the pest control in the crop was done automatically by a way of variety of animals, including birds that are attracted by these plants around the field and various types of insects that come into the small ecosystem created. It used to be a very interactive system even among humans because when the harvesting season comes, people in the village get together and do the harvesting collectively just for a lunch from the owner. So a farmer had enough to support his family, his children, and earning money was not the motive of that pattern of cultivation. But with the Green Revolution, there came high-yielding varieties, increased use of fertilizer and other agrochemical inputs, improved crops and machinery to some extent. And more importantly, then the system became more commercialized. So it seemed the farmers abandoned the sustainable agriculture. They used short-term paddy as well as other crop varieties. And along came massive application of fertilizers and other inputs to support these crops. And eventually farmers lost the fertility in the croplands, which further increased their dependency on external applications. There was a note by Ramani Jayatilaka, who says that the major objective of introducing the Green Revolution in Sri Lanka was to increase the total agricultural production, particularly to make the country self-sufficient in rice by increasing production. It was expected to improve the living standards of the rural population. So was the poverty reduced? Unfortunately, not much. Because though they were able to obtain a much higher yield, they in turn had to spend a lot on agricultural applications, fertilizers, weedicides, and then pesticides. Actually, CJ did an investigation on this pesticide application in North Central Province in 2012. And we came across a number of malpractices in pesticide application, such as farmers consulting the shop owner instead of the agricultural officer, and end up putting a pesticide targeted at larva stage on an adult insect. So it's ineffective. Thereby, the farmer applies another pesticide and another until he gets rid of that pest. And sometimes they even mix up 2-3 pesticides together to make it more effective, not even knowing what's the final effect. And ultimately, he ends up spending a lot on pest control. Same goes for fertilizer. And some women even get into microcredit traps in arranging money to buy fertilizer. So in Sri Lanka, most farmers are still low or middle income families. It even didn't ensure food security, because I can bring one good example from my experience, that is the spread of CKD-UE, which is the chronic kidney disease of unknown etiology. So in around 2002, disease started appearing among farmers. And although a clear reason was unknown, many scientists suspected the chemical contamination along with hard water, because majority among the patients were farmers in dry zone. Even before the economic crisis we undergo today, where even upper middle families have lost their access to sufficient, safe and nutritious food, in rural areas, there were women suffering from malnutrition. Sometimes even pregnant mothers either starve or just fill her stomach with something that would fulfill her dietary need, but still would not be sufficient to fulfill her nutritious needs, and would eventually put her child in the risk of malnutrition because the price of the food is not affordable for her. So you may wonder, if the food prices are so high, how come the farmers is too poor? That's because the profits all flows to the intermediate businessmen, not the poor peasant or their families. On one hand, they invest so much on the cultivation for seeds, for agrochemical inputs, manpower, machinery. And when the harvesting comes, they have to sell it to whatever the price. And sometimes if they sell the harvest for a good price, the intermediate increase their share, and ultimately the farmers would not be able to bear the cost of their own product if they want to buy it from the market. So that's how the things flow in the agribusiness in Sri Lanka. So ultimately, the green revolution in Sri Lanka was not successful in securing healthy or sufficient quantity of food at a fair price for farmers in Sri Lanka, I would say.
Perfect, Alanis. We want to go to the last year. In May, the government banned synthetic fertilizers in your country in an effort to make farming completely organic. So we would like to know, why did this action, why did it happen, if it was a result of advocacy work done by farmers or social groups or any other reason that you could tell us?
Well, there's no argument that the decision was one of the remarkable towards eliminating agrochemicals, but unfortunately, the intention behind is what not so remarkable. It was clearly a decision made by the government to save the dollars it spent on importing chemical fertilizer, which is around $400 million per year. We could say that the decision was a result of long-run advocacy of some academics, medical professionals, as well as some CSOs who advocated on eliminating the use of pesticides, especially who were researching on this chronic kidney disease of unknown etiology, and who believed that Sri Lanka must go back to its traditional farming system, because there are a lot of health issues coming around these chemical applications. But the way this decision was taken and implemented was a total mess. However, the government did take measures to issue permits under a special licensing system for import of specialized fertilizers, such as micronutrient fertilizer applied to flowers and foliage plants in the floriculture sector, only through the Department of Agriculture and other relevant agencies. But due to this limited supply, the prices of fertilizers used in floriculture went up. And most smallholder farmers who engaged in floriculture couldn't afford them. So although this decision was a great idea, it could not sustain due to these irregularities and clear lack of vision.
So you said some of the reasons, but I wanted to ask you if you want to elaborate a bit more about what have been the problems with this implementation of this ban.
Yes, on one hand, there was not enough organic fertilizer for farmers engaged in commercial farming, and they strongly believe that their harvest and thereby the income depends on this chemical fertilizer. So they were outraged. And there are some booster products introduced to the market that breaks the nutrition in organic fertilizers, but they were not sufficiently available. And some farmers were totally unaware of such products. And most importantly, the commercial scale farmers were not ready for this transition, because converting to organic is not as easy as converting to chemical applications. It needs some land preparations, applications of soil nutrition, and then allowing the organic matter to break down and release its nutrients. So there wasn't enough time between the ban and the implementation. Also, the decision followed was hilarious, because while trying to save farmers from chemical applications, the government tried to import some organic fertilizer, which was processed municipal waste. And we all know what the content of this municipal waste, which was found to have a bacteria called Ervinia that are potential plant pathogens that destroy crops. And also, this was a clear violation of the law of Sri Lanka. So CEJ even filed a lawsuit to stop unloading the allegedly contaminated organic fertilizer, because organic fertilizer from any country could not be imported to Sri Lanka under any circumstance, according to the regulations of the Plant Protection Ordinance. And as it prohibits the import of soil particles, living organisms, any virus, bacteria or fungus cultures into the country, because those organic manure made of decomposing animal and plant parts could consist of pathogens. So it was proved, because the testing showed that this avenue bacteria was found in these organic fertilizers. So clearly the government was not aware of how to implement this decision, because on one hand, the farmers were shouting, demanding for chemical fertilizers or at least the organic fertilizers, but there was not enough organic fertilizer available for that moment. Also, the floriculture sector, which consists of over around 150,000 individuals directly involved in the production and exports of these products, from the statistics of 2014, actually. So this shows some income around 14.9 million US dollars worth of foreign exchange. And this sector was also heavily impacted, because as I explained in the earlier section, although there were limited supply, the prices went high, so they could not afford it. On the other hand, they're totally dependent on chemical fertilizers. Although there are research on organic additives, the floriculturists were unaware of them, and those products were not popular in the market. Also, whatever the available fertilizers and additives, the prices went sky high. So they totally broke. This all actually increased the rage against the government, despite the important decision the government made.
And then I wanted to ask you, having had all these problems for the implementation of this ban, so what does it mean for farming in your country?
Mainly the decision affected on the food security of the country. So it says that the rice production was dropped by 20% in the 6 months the initiative was implemented. And the CSOs blamed the government that due to this effort of overnight acquisition of organic farming bombarded the initiatives that was ongoing quite slowly. And it was like an opportunity given to the agrochemical industry to be more popular among farmers as their only savior. So the reduction in the harvest made the farmers outraged and started protesting all over the country, which was then fueled by media. It made the whole initiative a bigger failure. Also, the government had to spend a lot on importation of the gap left by the production loss, and also to compensate the farmers.
Perfect, Chalani. So last year, you at Friends of the Earth Sri Lanka produced a roadmap of policies, laws and measures to successfully adopt agroecology. So we wanted to know what was the aim of these booklets.
Actually, the booklet was produced to guide the decision makers as well as those officers who implement the decisions at the ground level to proper adoption of agroecology. Actually, the concept broke out with the government's fertilizer ban was organic farming. But our advocacy was not merely replacing the fertilizer. It is only one of the practices in agroecology. So we advocate for agroecology, in which the use of synthetic chemicals is minimal and encourage maintaining the fertility of the soil and utilizing the activity of all living organisms and ensures their survival in cultivation. This leads to a healthy diet, which ultimately leads to a healthy society. In agroecology, cultivation is done while adapting to environmental processes and utilizing them while conserving natural resources. It encourages greater diversity of crops and breeds while discouraging the use of agrotoxics or use of dangerous new technologies such as genetically modified organisms. Agroecology is so eco-friendly and sustainable. So this book was a set of guidelines to go there in the Sri Lankan context.
So then what kind of impact has it had? I mean, for the peoples on the ground, but also for the politicians, you know, or the people in charge of producing the laws and adopting them.
As for the impact, actually, we only received the acknowledgement of the received by the parties we shared it with. But we hope to carry forth this advocacy until we see some result. Because there are some initiatives from the government themselves, like there are government-led farmer societies called Good Agriculture Practices Societies. But still, they are very slow and unpopular among commercial farmers, where the chemical applications are so high, so we still have a lot to do.
How widely is agroecology currently practiced in Sri Lanka? And if it is not really widely practiced, why not?
As I mentioned even earlier, there are a number of CSOs that advocate and practice agroecology with farmers and some government-led initiatives for smallholder farmers, such as the GAP or Good Agriculture Practices Farmer Societies, organic villages introduced by the Department of Agriculture that engages women in gardening, beekeeping, etc. And the government deployed even army officers to carry out organic farming. But they are not widely practiced, especially among commercial farmers. Actually, CEJ conducted a webinar on the present and future of the organic farming problem in January this year. And a number of problems were highlighted during this. One is less willingness and commitment of both farmers as well as agriculture research officers who are only familiar to chemical supplements. Another was lack of coordination between researchers, officers, and decision makers to apply findings of the research into decisions. Also, the lack of technical know-how to meet the demand using agroecology, which needs to change the attitude of the farming communities, one of the main challenges in implementing agroecology in Sri Lanka. Also, I would say that the less availability of chemical alternatives is a problem. Lack of ingredients, time, and equipment to self-produce such alternatives, and sometimes there are less effectiveness compared to chemical applications. And also, awareness, less availability, and low harvest of traditional crop varieties by now, because we've been practicing this commercial farming for so long that we are so addicted to hybrid varieties. It's a huge challenge in this conversion. Also, lack of some facilities like organic certification that maintain the standards of organic fertilizer as well as other organic products is another gap we need to fill in reaching agroecology, because when the farmlands are all interconnected, the conversion of one farmer or a few don't really count. So it has to be the whole farmland. Ultimately, the market is a huge challenge for farmers engaged in agroecology because they get a lesser harvest, so it needs to have a good price. But the customers in Sri Lanka are mostly those who look to buy cheap, except for a few that are worried about the health and also are rich enough to afford it. But the majority is among the ones that look for whatever the cheap. So I think this is one of the reasons we need to push for a gradual and a whole conversion rather than sectoral in order to achieve food sovereignty through agroecology.
Perfect, Chalani. And is there any legal framework supporting the practice of agroecology in Sri Lanka?
Well, yes. But I would say that the problem is with their implementation. Most of the time, CJ had to intervene and point out what is there in the law to the officials and thereby to stop them from being violated. For example, when the government decided to import organic fertilizers, CJ intervened and pointed out what's being violated here. The Plant Protection Ordinance, actually enforcing Sri Lanka, makes provisions against the production of any organism harmful to or injurious to or destructive to plants and for the sanitation of plants in Sri Lanka, which basically prohibits importation of organic fertilizer, especially when they are not quality controlled. Also under the Section 23N of National Environmental Act of Act Number 47 of 1980, soil pollution is a punishable offense. And as there is a possibility of contamination of Sri Lankan soil by importing organic fertilizer from another foreign country, it is also an offense under this section. Because importing persist municipal solid waste is no way of promoting agroecology. So they have to be produced within the country, and these provisions could be used for that. In fact, this was bringing back what was already there, because Sri Lanka had a good agriculture system. Also back in 2011, CEJ stood against the importation of pesticides to Sri Lanka containing harmful constituents like arsenic, mercury and other heavy metals by submitting forged and illegal data and documentation to Sri Lankan authorities. So CEJ asked to reform the law for such contaminated pesticides to make them unable to import and distribute. And it was concluded when the Attorney General's department started taking instructions from the relevant government authorities to prepare regulations on importing pesticides. So the Control of Pesticides Act, Customs Ordinance, National Environmental Act, and Consumer Affairs Authority Act are all there to regulate hazardous and toxic chemicals thereby can be used to spread agroecology. In addition, the Agriculture and Agrarian Services Act, Agrarian Development Act, Irrigation Ordinance, Irrigation Act, Soil Conservation Act, Plant Protection Act, the Seed Act can all be used to push agroecology. There were also some initiatives like under the nationally determined contributions of Sri Lanka that they submitted last year, 2021. Sri Lanka had been made it a mandatory requirement to adopt good agriculture practices in productivity enhancement programs of food crops. And there was an initiative to implement the integrated plant nutrition system by the Department of Agriculture in order to reduce the use of artificial fertilizer. So these are actually some of those existing systems and practices to promote agroecology in Sri Lanka. But again, I would highlight that we have a serious issue of proper implementation of these laws, as well as the commitment from the officers to believe and establish the agroecological model. And actually, currently, the biggest challenge is to separate the concept of organic farming and agroecology, which are clearly two different ideas.
So we wanted to know, what does the recent debt crisis and political shifts in Sri Lanka mean for small-scale producers and farmers in the country?
Well, this is a difficult question. First, because if I say that all small-scale producers and farmers were affected, it is not entirely true, because smallholder farmers have a little to lose and they are mostly self-sufficient. But it doesn't mean that all farmers were not affected. When it comes to medium-scale producers and farmers, that the production depends on a considerable amount of fertilizers, chemical additives, and whose portion of the product goes to the market, were severely affected. Secondly, even small-scale farmers and producers got affected with the inflation. The price of capital such as seeds increased and their cost of living increased. So maybe not as much as the commercial scale farmers, but these small scale producers and smallholder farmers were victims too. Especially the fuel crisis that came up as a result of the debt crisis, because the country did not have sufficient money to import fuel, made farmers and even fishermen fell to the bottom. They were unable to operate machinery to engage in pre-preparation of the fields, and fishermen could not go fishing. So the overall productivity as well as their income drastically dropped. So this is all on top of one after another disaster. When it comes to farmers, they first suffered the scarcity of fertilizer, then the drop of harvest, and then when the fertilizer was available, after their protest, the price of fertilizer was sky high, and that's when the fuel shortage came. And some of them even suffered the lack of access to market due to this fuel shortage. This is actually because Sri Lanka practices a centralized market system where the harvest is brought to a central marketplace and distributed from there rather than decentralized system where they can have the market nearby. So the fuel shortage even affected the market due to transportation as well as the price of products. Also, when it was COVID, the central marketplace was often closed or the prices were fluctuating overnight, made the life very difficult for farmers. Because in these fluctuations, the intermediates were the ones that profited. And when it comes to the fishermen, they suffered a cyclone called Yas and then the pandemic, which blocked their market access due to health restrictions in movement. And then the most of the fishermen from the western province actually got beaten by the express pearl ship disaster, and the fishermen from north suffered due to the bottom trawlers coming from India to extract their harvest in a very destructive manner. And on top of all this, they had to suffer the fuel crisis. So they were actually put down to zero. Also, due to the political instability and fuel crisis, the government offices did not function as normal. So the farmers lost access to these facilities offered by government during this phase. Also, the sudden increase in the cost of living for farmers that just manage their all-year expenses with half-year income, where climate is not favorable for year through cultivation, this situation was a huge impact. On top of all these, the government decisions to take up other state forest land where some indigenous communities and smallholder farmers were cultivating to employ them into more productive economic activities according to the government, but in reality had nothing to do with smallholder farmers rather than providing space for large-scale businessmen, allowing corporate control of our lands and food production made it very difficult for these smallholder farmers. So I would say that last 2 years must be the worst nightmare of all our producers and farmers.
Real World Radio, broadcasting free words, building popular communications by FOI.